Hello, Jason speaking here.
Yes, I just want to see if we are indeed on air. It's Kalk van der Merwe speaking with your edition of this evening's Radio Free South Africa. Yes, I can see all our guests and the studio. I think we are ready to go, guys. Can you hear me? How are you tonight, Jason? I can definitely see you, and Professor Boyson, I can see you. How are you guys doing?
So I'm all good to go.
Yeah, I'm ready to go in Vancouver as well, Skull. Harry Boyens.
I just want to put off my other device now because at this point in time we're running two devices. For some reason, the server dropped us.
Yeah, Skulk Harry Boyens, I'm here again.
Jason is here. I can hear you, Harry.
Skulk, my system tells me that everybody's on except you have now left. We clearly are having terrific trouble.
Jason's here.
Well, guys, let's try again.
Okay.
Why not?
So you have Harry Boyens again?
Technical problems tonight. I'm trying to produce on my side. As you know, Karen.
Okay, this is Pat Rabbit. I am going to try and pull Jason in. I'm going to try and pull Scott in, and maybe I can get those people in.
Jason, yeah.
Well, oh, well.
Let's try again.
Okay, this is Pat Rabbit again. Now, what I'm going to do is add Skulk. Then I'm going to add Jason, and Skulk can maybe pull in the guests because I do not have the guests' Skype. Okay, I'm Skulk right now. Now, let's add Jason. So Skulk is unavailable. Okay, this is Pat Rabbit again. Now, what I'm going to do... Oops. Forgot to turn that off. Let's see who I have on the call, if anybody. Come here, you. Okay, I'm trying to call Jason. I'm trying to call Skulk, and I don't have the guests, so one of the other two may call him when they get going. But this is Radio Free South Africa with Karen Smith, and Karen's out at the moment, and also Skulk van der Merwe. And I'm having a hard time getting him also. I don't know why I can't call Jason. Come here. Two group members not on the call. Well, he ought to be on the call because he's showing he's on Skype. I may have to tell Skulk to ask him to hang up to free up his phone if he happens to be. Try again. Let's see. Don't know why I can't get through to Jason. Because he was showing. No, I don't see him at all. Oh, great. Okay. Pardon me while I talk to myself. Jason Bartlett. Okay. Now, Ed. If he happens to be on a call with someone else, that may be why I'm not able to pull him in.
Okay, gentlemen, let's try again. It's very
I can
difficult.
Hear you much clearer now.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
You have
yeah.
Harry again.
Thank you, Prof. We're sitting with a peculiar technical problem. Everything is okay in studio. I can see my studio server. I can see Harry. I can see Jason. I see myself. But for some reason, the sound is not going out in Texas from the broadcasting end, which is a very peculiar problem. I've never experienced it like that. I think let's proceed until the turn of the hour, until 10 o'clock. It's about 20 minutes. Then we go off air. Then we have a program. It's recorded and everything. and then I will try to fix the problem from a technical side. But unfortunately, things like this sometimes occur. I really apologize to both you, my esteemed guests. So yes, Professor Boyens, you were still saying and you were still guiding Jason in what to expect, especially when he arrives in Washington, and what he can expect from the people on that side.
Yeah, I'm pretty convinced. Look, let me put it this way. I think Jason has somehow, unfortunately, picked possibly just the worst conceivable time for this, because he's walking into a highly politicized Washington at this point, where anything that can be held against a candidate can and will be held against him, and it will be hammered in with a mallet into the head. And I believe that President Trump's advisors will be telling him that the matter of South Africa is potentially an albatross around his neck, and that he should avoid it like the plague. That is what I believe will happen, unless some men of character finally make their way into Washington and actually stand up for what is right. I don't have much faith that that will happen. Washington has never been a place to go look for real people of depth. So trouble kind of floats in the general direction of Washington. It's been a long time since there have been men there that one can stand next to. So and that is also why President Trump is there, to clean the swamp, drain the swamp. The place is a swamp. It's humanly a swamp, character-wise a swamp. So the problem is that you're right in the heart of an election here, and I think what this means is that in terms of speaking to people, you would have to get advice from folks in that circle as to who are the right people to talk to. But going in there, so to speak, with guns blazing, I think will not work. This is a case where you'd have to go to find very specific ears, and they will no doubt sit on it until after November.
And then, Professor Boyens, as I was saying, we need that correct entry point. When Jason reaches Washington, that entry point is going to be crucial to stop him from facing doors being slammed in his face, and people not willing to listen. And we need to find those entry points. Jason, from your side?
Yes, from my side, there was a few things touched on that I would like to elaborate on. And I think the first thing I can agree with completely is when Harry states that South Africans need to stop hiding behind Christianity and always take a punch in the face and say nothing, and because they are dying, but they're dying quietly. And that's exactly what's been happened, because, you know, they go out drinking Friday and Saturday, and then on Sunday they put their best clothes on and they go to church and they think that that's Christianity. But I say that there's not Christianity. They need to start bucking up and turning to God, who actually saved them in the first place, who gave the very Afrikaner and the Boer nation a grounds to stand on with the day of the vow that these pagans have tried to take away from them. And when it comes to with Washington, obviously we're already in contact with several people in the Trump administration, and I agree fully, like, it doesn't help anybody goes in guns blazing. Hence I've come completely peacefully, and I walk in complete faith. There's a, you know, I might not have all the education in the world, but I do have a very faithful heart. And I know in the worst times is when the biggest miracles happen. And I don't mind anybody who doesn't have faith can say whatever they want. I know what's true. And I know what I believe, and I know what I've got as knowledge and discernment. So I really do agree with the, what Harry says there, that the Christians of South Africa need to stop hiding behind it, because they've been manipulated with the very book that they meant to believe in. They've let these people on the left, like these Marxists and communists, actually manipulate them with the exact book that they have been brought up with, and they've manipulated them in a very negative way. And I do understand, like he also says, that it's a difficult time because of the elections. But we also need to start realizing we've kept quiet and nobody's said anything for the last 25 years. Yes, they've tried, but everybody ends up trying to make an extra quick buck here or a quick buck here at the price of their people. And I've got nothing to lose because I've got nothing left. They've taken everything. Now they want to try tax our money, even though I haven't worked or lived in South Africa permanently for quite a long time. So it's a very difficult time, but when is the right time? When will the right time be? And I agree as well, there's no political solution and there's no political answer like you asked, Harry. It's very, very difficult because there is no political answer, because it's going to be putting anybody who looks at it in jeopardy. But that's why I've taken the initiative to go to someone like President Trump, because he's bold enough to call a spade a spade.
Yes, indeed. And we need to do that. There was a pussyfooting around this issue for very long. And I don't want to go into specific organizations or people, especially not in a program like this one. In some other cases, I will definitely do it. But there's been this very soft handling of the whole issue. In South Africa, there was that infamous radio broadcast on one of the black, actually one of the black radio FM stations, in which a prominent white person that was for many years, he's been writing books about this whole thing, and he was pushed into a corner and said, but is there a genocide going on? And he said, no, there is no genocide going on. So we need to step back from that point or that place. There is a genocide going on. To all intents and purposes, it is a genocide, not only of white people, of black people also, 500,000 killed in 25 years. That is not a genocide, what is. And we really need to start punching hard, but punching at the right places. That's my point of view of the whole situation.
I was going to suggest that, Jason, if you ever get a chance, get yourself the e-book version of my book, Amabulu, and then follow the history of a guy called Johannes van der Kemp, who was the man who started off the London Missionary Society in South Africa around 1800. And, hell came to Africa under the protection of the cloth. These men pretended to represent God. What they represented was something totally alien.
Yeah.
And they caused misery and hell on earth in that country ever since. And I lay at their feet, I accuse them of causing everything that's happened to South Africa. And they had the full support of what then passed for the media in Britain. And America had no news of its own in 1800. Whatever it thought of the world is what Britain told it to think.
Yeah.
And even in the Boer War, the New York Times was just republishing what it heard in London. And that is how the New York Times suddenly printed an article to say that during the Boer War, when women and children were dying in concentration camps, they published a British article saying that, oh, no, the ladies can play tennis all day. The New York Times published that. Okay?
Wow.
And you need to understand that this problem doesn't just come from 1970-something. It doesn't just come from when the professor told me I should just die. It doesn't come from 1948 when the first apartheid law was made. It comes from 1800, and it was exported systematically across the Western world. And South Africa has been the canary in the coal mine ever since then.
Yeah. No, yes, I agree. I
That's also the God on the truth. And in all of our programs, this comes out. Every one of our guests basically says what Professor Boyne said now, and you said it. We are looking at the future of America, North America, not only the United States, North America, 10 to 15 years. If it's that long, we're looking into the future, what's going to happen your side, if you look at what's happening in South Africa. So don't sham the Afrikaners. Don't call the Boer people bad names because you've been misled through many years, many decades, and even centuries. Look at what is actually happening because you can be taught a lesson from it. And that's maybe also one of the angles that you can throw at people, Jason, from your side.
Cool.
I agree with that, Scott.
The one thing, Jason, is when I wrote that tome of mine, I made a point of making sure that in every chapter there's a clear connection to the United States. There's 30 chapters. So there's a reason for that. It's not just to keep the interest of Americans. It's because our histories are tied together way more closely than what Americans understand. Just because we were 4.5 million people in South Africa and they 350 million doesn't mean there's no connection. We have the same surnames. We have the same history. My wife's one ancestor at the Cape in 1666 came from New York.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I'm in a city in Bartlett right now. It's got my last name. So I understand what you mean.
Yeah. So there's no dodging this. And I think Americans need to understand that what has happened to us is what their future looks like. They don't have to write books about it. They don't have to, you know, pay people to analyze things. The fee to find out the truth is around $1,500. You get on a plane, you fly to South Africa, and you don't go to the tourist destinations. Okay? How about they just go live for a week on a farm with a regular South African farmer, just so they can see what the truth actually looks like? Okay? Because this is what is waiting for the West if it continues down the road that it's busy with. And it will get there very much more quickly if people like Bernie Sanders can help it.
Yes, no, for sure. I understand that completely, and I agree with you on that one. And I understand that you also say that most of it came underneath the cloth, and that's correct. But that's where judgment will start. It will start in the church because there's a lot of evil in the church in an all-round figure. But it doesn't mean that, just like we say that we mustn't pick on the Boers, doesn't mean every Christian is the cause of this. Where I'm standing up as a devout Christian, I'm standing on the word of the Bible, not on what history books say. I stand on what God says and what he speaks and what he does, because he has been silenced countless times, and hence we are in the predicament we are. That's why I respect a lot of people that say that they aren't Christians, but they still let me speak, because as soon as they say to me, no, we'll take God out of it and let's just have a normal interview, then I say, well, that's fine. The reason why we took God out of it is because that's the reason why we're in the predicament we're in. So that's why I'm standing exactly up, and not everybody's going to spend $1,500 and come. So I will have to do my mission and continue sticking to it, because bit by bit we are making a difference. And if everybody does their own little part, we would make a massive difference.
Yeah. So in the end, to get back to the question that Skulk asked, I think your challenge is finding the right people to speak to, the right ones that will listen. And my prediction will be that they would have to probably keep quiet until after November, and then they may be able to do something. But we've already seen, you know, with President Trump's previous with John Bolton, some of the South Africans met with John Bolton. I think you're aware of that. And
yes.
And now, you know, he's fallen out of favor.
Yeah, that was quite a predicament that came our way, because it's a fact that the guys from AfriForum, when they won on that side, and they also spoke on Fox News just recently in the week past, Aaron Sarutz was once again on Fox News. But their entry point, and once again we're speaking of entry points, was John Bolton. And now John Bolton has fallen wayside. He's actually now opposing Trump. So even on that personal level, it becomes very difficult, if not impossible, to get the right message through. It's a huge predicament that we're sitting with.
Yeah, the people I would have in mind are not in Washington at all. But if there's a single man in Washington who I think has a value system that counts for something, it's probably Senator Lindsey Graham.
Yes, I agree with you. No, as I say, it is going to be – it's an uphill battle, but we have started speaking to the administration, and there's been a lot of outreach. So I, for one, I have faith. Something's been laid on my heart, and I'm an obedient person. So I know that there's always going to be people that are against it and for it. And I know you guys are for me. I'm not saying you. I'm just saying I know there are people out there that are always going to be against it. And that's what makes it so different to be a devout Christian, is because you can believe on the crazy stuff. And in the complete turmoil and in the middle of the lion's den, you've got an utmost peace that most people will never experience. And I have a complete peace because do I know the end result of this walk? No. But do I want fame for it? No, because I don't want fame for walking for the persecution of my people. That's not something someone wants to be famous for. But am I willing to, you know, suffer for my people? Yes, because no one suffered for me. I'm 33 years old, and I've seen no one suffer except the people that are brutally murdered in my family, in my town, and in my countries, in my country. So, you know, so I'm sick of it. So I've just said, you know what, I don't stand for this anymore. And that's why I started my walk, and I do it with such joy. My spirits are up, because even if I help 100 people in South Africa, I'm happy, because I've received probably between 10 and 25,000 messages over the last 2 months of people just stating to me that, you know, this is the first amount of hope they've seen. I've received messages from old Afrikaner farmers in the Kalahari and from the Free State and all over who never ever say anything, and they message me and they say, finally someone we can actually trust to tell the truth. And I don't take that lightly. I take that with almost tears in my eyes, to think that I'm just some mediocre person from South Africa, but I'm willing to tell the truth, and I'm not going to be politically correct. So that might make my opposition even stronger, but that's okay, because it just takes one man to sit alone and do nothing for things to get worse.
That's a fact. And Jason, you must when I interview you, every time I interview you, and I'm not a very emotional person. I think you've realized that over some time. I'm a very matter of fact type of a person. If a thing is a thing, that's it. I don't go and cry my eyes out about it. But when I interview you, I'm sitting here with goosebumps, little goosebumps, because what you are doing, nobody else has ever done before. It's as simple as that. But what you do, it's really heroic. So we are rooting for you, and we're supporting you. Harry went before you even knew about him. Harry went and he wrote this magnificent article about you, actually introducing you to a level of friends that maybe you're not even aware of it. So you must realize the immense amount of support that you have in your struggle. It's immense. It doesn't look like that because the mass media is covering it, but it's immense out there.
Well, together we will do it. And thank you so much for your support. It's been unbelievable. I love talking to you guys every 2 weeks. You guys are incredible. Thank you so much for your support. And I will continue for you and my people and your grandchildren and their great-grandchildren.
So, Jason, when you get to meet with these folks, it's important that you get them to understand that these funny white South Africans are actually their closest cousins.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Yes.
We'll be right back after this message.
Thank you, guys. We could just mute our mics, and we could quickly have a discussion as to the next hour. This is Talk for the Marva, and you're listening to Radio Free South Africa. Yes, our first half included the magnificent guest, Mr. Jason Bartlett, walking all the way from Texas to D.C. to bring the message that things are really not well in South Africa. People are being killed in scores, and basically the rest of the world is turning a blind eye. But for the next part of our show, the next hour or so, myself and Professor Boyens will also speak about the situation that has changed rapidly and is changing rapidly in the United States. As we speak, there was the failed impeachment of President Trump the last couple of weeks. And then, of course, Trump 2020 is coming on and a host of other things going on in the United States. Prof. Boyson, from your side, what's going on in the U.S.? Is things still on the road or is it falling apart? What's happening?
The thing is, well, first of all, let's be clear. I live in Canada. I'm a Canadian, originally born in South Africa, but I've been a keen student of the United States, I guess, ever since I was about 25. So hopefully that counts for something. And have lived and worked there. I do no longer do so. I am retired in Vancouver in Canada. So that just to place myself geographically. I will tell you this. Let me just make sure that I get this date right. This is my own article. I wrote on Sunday, 15 May, 2016. I said the first edition of this article I published on 3 May. Just before President Trump won the Indiana primary. I have a good friend in Indiana, and he told me there's no way Trump's going to win. And I told him, watch this space. And I told him that from Vancouver. There must have been a reason why I said that. So you ask me, are things still on track? Now, there was a complete mess with the 2016 election, in that I don't think Hillary Clinton ever knew what she was up against. That was my take all the time. I actually drew a map. I drew what's known generally as a scattergram. I'm an analyst. I'm a physicist. I analyze things and I try and lay them out so they make sense. Physicists are basically guys who are never at rest until they understand the thing. And I figured at that point, okay, now I got it. And I realized that the United States had spent several decades socially running to the left, to the right, to the left, to the right, without drawing the proper map that one sees of politics in most countries. The oddest things were deemed left and the oddest things were deemed right and so forth in the U.S. And that's because they didn't draw both axes of the map. So they didn't have a map. They had a line. And Hillary obviously thought that, as the ex-reigning queen, she was just a shoe-in for anything. All she had to do was show her face and she would win. And nothing could have been further from the truth. I ended off this analytical article. I'll put down here what I wrote at the time. All this tells me that in the absence of Clinton being indicted, Donald Trump is going to win this election. This is me in May 2016.
Yes.
All this analysis tells me that in the absence of Clinton being indicted, I still think she should be indicted. In the absence of her being indicted, Donald Trump is going to win this election unless his mouth gets in the way. The Democrats, for their part, had better pray Clinton gets indicted so Joe Biden can run. He was not yet as mentally flaky as he is now. He's obviously flaky. I trust Americans will elect a president that will make the leading country of the free world strong again. I have lost the country of my birth to the kind of forces that lurk in the Obama administration. I have seen it thereby turned into a hellhole and a dangerous laughingstock. I cannot stomach the destruction of Western civilization one inch further. My advice to Hillary Clinton? Dissociate yourself from Barack Obama as fast and as far as you can. ordinary adult American men are mad as hell at what Obama has done with their country. There are awfully many of them, and they talk to their wives.
Yes.
None of that has changed. All that has happened is the people who thought Obama was a good president, who didn't care about what he did to the United States, okay, those people have ganged up in an illegal fashion on President Trump.
Yes.
And the ordinary males of America are still mad as hell, and they aim to put these people in their place. I think President Trump was correct last night when he said, "Thank you, Nancy, for trying to impeach me." Okay?
Yes. Yes.
The left in the United States has painted itself into a corner from which it cannot escape. It's now a win or die for them. So I don't know who's doing the thinking, but man, are they out to lunch somewhere. It's terrible. There seems to be only one Democrat anywhere talking any sense, and that's James Carville, the so-called Raging Cajun. And he's basically telling them, come back to daddy, please.
Yes, because Professor Brewer, I've never seen. Yes, I've seen viciousness in the American politics. They are known for running extremely vicious and personal campaigns, but the viciousness since 2016, 2017 against Trump in his person, his wife, his son, yeah, his young son, to any person, any sane and rational person, that is at least shocking. To me, it's nauseating. I'm a father myself, and when I read the things that they say about his young son at some stage, they were going after that young boy, it's nauseating. I cannot see myself in any way supporting a party or a group of people that goes out in vicious terms like that.
So the I agree with you that U.S. politics has been a blood sport for a long time, and it's got very ugly over many years. But I have never seen this level of absolutely mind bile dripping hatred in my life. I honestly believe, as I sit here, that the Democrats have reached the point, or many in that party have reached the point, where they will help the military enemy of the United States if that will get rid of President Trump. They have no principles left. They have no morals left. They have there's no basic value system left. They have thrown it all by the wayside, and it's as though their entire human being is just one gland, and that gland produces a kind of bile that makes them froth by the mouth, and they just keep saying, hate, 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 must hate Trump. They get up in the morning and they say, must hate Trump. I've never seen humans behave like this. I've had to shake the hand of the guy who tried to kill my mother. Can you see these people ever even, getting close to anything like that? It's just mind-boggling.
The tearing up of the speech, the State of the Nation speech, Nancy Pelosi being the most senior, most probably the most senior person in the Democrat Party, on the same level as Trump himself, doing something as silly as tearing up his speech. Now, it's a small thing maybe, but it's in symbolic terms, it's a huge thing that actually happened.
Yes, it is.
Why is this happening? Is it rapid jealousy? Is it desperate fear? Why do they want to take out Trump in any way possible? What's going on?
I can only speculate, but let me try the following picture with you. When all is said and done, presidents come and presidents go. They make policies that can stand for a while but can be overturned by the next guy. That is a cycle of 4 years that often gets renewed for another four, so that you effectively have a left-right swing in the United States with a frequency or a period, really, of 8 years. Okay? So it's like a wave that runs through the nation that cycles back and forth every 8 years. And I should say the wavelength's really 16 years. It takes about 16 years to get back to where you were. Now, there's something that is happening on the watch of President Trump that these ordinary little kids in the street who yell and scream, and the Antifa types and the Ocasio-Cortez types and these people, I don't much listen to anything they say. I don't think they got any brains. But there's something happening in the background that President Trump has once or twice alluded to, mentioned here and there, but it's actually one of the big reasons why people voted for him and one of the big reasons why they stick with him. And it's one of the things that is making the ground crumble under the feet of the Democrats. And that is the fact that he's already appointed two Supreme Court judges. And if Ruth should retire, which is very likely, even in this year, then he gets to appoint a third. From that point on, it's going to be something like two generations before Democrats, or if you wish, the left, the liberals of the United States, it's going to be two generations before they will have control of the Supreme Court again. So, strategically, to me, the big deal about Trump is not all the stuff he says. It's not all the sort of dramatic stuff that you see on the news all day. It's not the speeches. It's not who's screaming bile against him. It has to do with the fact that he is quietly appointing judges. He has a list of conservative judges that the Federalist Society gave him. He has been studiously working his way down that list. He has appointed not far short of 200 judges at various senior levels, making sure that he is appointing a wall of conservative judges. I'm waiting to see him dent the Ninth Circuit Court, which is the court where the appeals court where the Democrats keep running to. It's a very liberal court. I think it's centered on California. So whenever they want to overturn anything Trump does, they quickly run to the Ninth Circuit Court to get an injunction or something. And then a judge there duly issues the injunction, and then Trump can't do that thing anymore. I'm waiting for the moment when that Ninth Circuit Court has been swung. And I'm waiting for Ruth Bader Ginsburg to go, because that's going to be the final bell. And so I'm hoping that happens before November of this year. But if Trump wins again, he's got another 4 years to wait for Ginsburg to go.
So what you're actually saying is it's about control of the judiciary, not even the political side of the American society anymore. It goes back to
To me, it's about, it's not so much control of the judiciary, it's about the independence of the judiciary. The judiciary is not independent. Over so many years of Democrat hegemony, the judiciary in the United States has been swung into like an activist organization. People just want it back to normal. And that is why they like what Trump has done. I sat at a table where a very nice gentleman spoke to me, and we talked about President Trump, and this was in 2017. And he said, "Harry, you know, I don't like the moral standards by which he has lived his life. I don't like the way he speaks. I don't really particularly much like what he stands for. All I like is one important thing, and that is that he keeps appointing conservative judges, and he's been true to his word on that. So as long as he sits there and does that, I'm happy and I'll support him.
I understand fully what you're saying here. And for middle class and lower class, working class, we call it people in America, it's working. It's working. We can go and really analyze the economics of the United States and find a lot of fault and say to ourselves, it's a bubble, he's creating a bubble and it's a burst. I don't think that's really the case. But for average Joe American, whether it's white collar or blue collar, the Trump administration actually makes sense in the pocket. And that's very crucial. If you have more money to spend at the end of the day, and that's directly because of the policies of your government or your president, obviously you are going to support it. And that is also something that the Democrats simply don't get. They think that the hand as to people can solve that problem. But the people think a little bit further. They think about the job and the security of the job and the house, etc. And once again, their policies as the Democrats, the socialist policies that they adhere to, can never do what Trump is doing at this point. They can never replace them.
Skalka, are you still there?
Yes, Professor.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. No, I'm getting a lot of static here. So. Yeah, look, that's how I made my predictions in 2016, and I don't see any reason to change anything on that, is that I made a little map, and folks draw it for themselves. Axis, I have on the left, and on the right. I have entitlement at the bottom, and I have opportunity at the top. That states what happens in politics. Yes. Down on the map. I have terrible noise here.
Yes, I lost you also now for some time from your side. I see that the producer is also typing something for us. Yes.
I'll just keep going. So the point that I'm making is that there is a map that is worth drawing. And I think every American should make this stupid little map. It's simple. You make a vertical, you make a horizontal. Along the vertical, at the top, you write opportunity. And at the bottom, you write entitlement. Those are the two opposites. Some people just want the opportunity to do their thing in life. And they either get rich or they don't. And they just want that opportunity. At the bottom end of the map are those who think that you're entitled to things, and they will forever increase the list of things they believe you're entitled to and who's entitled to it. On the horizontal, on the left-hand end of the map, you put social liberal, and on the right-hand end, you put social conservative. If you draw that map, you go back to 2016, then you can put Trump at the top of the map under the word opportunity. You can put Bernie Sanders at the bottom next to the word entitlement. You can put Hillary next to the word social liberal. I mean, she did call, policemen pigs. And you can put Ted Cruz on the far right. Quite frankly, Hillary's opponent wasn't Trump. It was Ted Cruz. She was fighting her election as though she's fighting Cruz.
Yes, that's
the guy in the middle of the map was Tom Kasich at the time. And I know several Democrats who were happy to vote for him, even though he was a Republican. So my comment is, by the time Kasich and Cruz cleared out of the picture, Hillary was running unopposed as a social liberal fighting something that wasn't there. She was fighting a ghost. She did not understand that Trump was all about the word opportunity. He's a businessman. She could never get her head around that. She still can't. And this is why she lost. Now you can go and do the calculations of who got how many delegates in which state and all that kind of fancy stuff. But fundamentally, that election was lost long before they got to the actual voting booth. That election was lost round about the time that Trump became the Republican nominee, because it was as though the Democrats never understood what the phenomenon was that they're fighting. And they still don't. They honestly still don't. They're in such a paranoid state of denial, you know, like the 4 or 5 or 7 stages of grief. These guys can't get out of it. They're stuck. And all they're doing is spitting bile, and they're cursing this guy, and it's like they can never see what he's doing. He's constantly from left field for them, and they think they're fighting Ted Cruz. They're not. They're fighting Donald Trump.
Yes, yes. For which
they just don't understand the map.
Exactly. For which, and you're summing it up. I'm sitting here all ears, because it makes so much sense when you basically just explain to us in these simple terms. It's exactly what was going on. Trump is all about opportunity, and that is what he said from the start. That is what he said. Make America great again. Let's build the American business again. Bring opportunities back. Bring job opportunities back. Opportunity, opportunity. And I think that rang true with the average American who was sitting there in despair after Democrat, after many years, 8 years of Obama. Of course it was the good news that Trump was telling the people. And he's delivering on it. He's delivering on it.
Well, what I said in 2016, and I still stand by these words, I wrote, Trump's presence has in effect redefined the election as a struggle between the top and the bottom of this map, instead of between American liberals and conservatives. I would submit that those Americans positioned in the top half of this map are mostly people with a love of country who either have a job or have lost a job, and who may have a family and a house with a mortgage. Some 3.5 million of those mortgages were still underwater in 2016. This includes some of my own Democrat friends. They're generally having a hard time making headway in that economic system at that time. However, they accept that one works to get ahead in life, and they don't expect handouts. They believe in the American dream and have pride in America and its position in the world. They feel pained by America's diminished international status under Obama and want it restored. Where the left miscalculates is in assuming that women do not feel the plunge in American status worldwide. Married women in particular certainly see what's happening to their children and their country, and they do not like it one little bit. This position is also more ethnically blind than the talking heads on TV are prepared to concede. Because the map also includes millennials who've discovered that their latest iPhone doesn't have a Give Me a Job app. They're trying to do something about it rather than to protest as backpacks with legs. So, and if you think about it, and this is the thing I've always admired about the United States, it's the thing that everybody in the world admires about the United States. It is the land of what? There's a missing word. The land of opportunity. It's not the land of handouts. It's not the land of civil liberties. It's the land of opportunity. Can I, as a non-American, please appeal to Americans to understand who they are when they look in the mirror? They are the land of opportunity. They're the nation who made it the land of opportunity. What the hell are people like Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez even doing there?
Yes. Yeah, because their platform is just simply, we're going to give you a handout. We're going to give you something in return for your vote, which has worked tremendously well for the ANC in South Africa, because I want to start drawing parallels to South Africa now.
Yeah.
But you can only take it that far, and then people are starting to realize this is not sustainable. We can't do it. It's not going to work forever. I do not want to be a couch potato the rest of my life. I want to be something. I want to take the opportunity. I want to become a terribly rich person. Many years ago, I was still in organized business. We had a meeting at that point with Pravin Gordhan and Rob Davies, and they were going on in this meeting about 5 million jobs. They want to create 5 million jobs and 5 million jobs. And I stopped them and I said to them, guys, you simply don't understand the fundamentals. We don't need 5 million jobs. We need a millionaires in South Africa. We need a million businesses that's working. Then you will have your 5 million jobs overnight. So your focus is wrong. You just simply don't understand and get that basic of what you are now telling me to Professor Buen's opportunity. I must have described it to them in those terms, and maybe it would have sank in. It didn't sink in, because there's still a war on business people in South Africa. But yes, that is what we are also looking for in South Africa. What's your opinion on this?
Well, yeah, I think that the trouble in South Africa is that the people running the country have a culture that doesn't understand the basic tenets of business. They don't understand where money comes from. They don't understand how it's created. And their concept of life is that there's only so much money in a big central bucket somewhere in the country, and they want a big portion of it, thank you very much. They can't do maths because sometime or other they'll have to realize that you cannot steal from 10% of the population to make 90% of the population rich. It will never work. How can it work? So they're mathematically challenged. They can't do maths.
Yes. Do you think we can bring the same message to the South African people? Do you think the average South African is sophisticated enough? He's certainly not on the level of the average American, but is he sophisticated enough to actually realize there's another way than handouts? There's a way of opportunity? Is that possible?
Scott, I've worked in an R&D organization along with people of all ethnic groups in South Africa. In the team were Indian guys, so-called colored folks from the Cape, several black people, several Afrikaans-speaking white people, several English-speaking South African whites, etc. There would be no problem explaining that to them. The problem is that there is this enormous, almost 50 million now, of which the guys I've just described are an infinitesimally small number. And that huge group honestly believes that, you know, the money is made somewhere and that all you got to do is whatever it takes to just take it, get it, steal it. And they've been taught by the government that to steal money is good. South Africa has a government that teaches people to steal. That's what it does.
Yes.
It is, I don't think there's any other place on earth that I can think of where such a vast amount of resources and cash is under the control of what is historically a terrorist organization that happens to side repeatedly with Iran.
Yes, yes. Because the ANC in itself is still not even a terrorist. It's a criminal organization. We know it's criminal because many of the MPs, the members of parliament sitting there, are criminals, are people with criminal records. And it's not me giving an opinion to say, well, these are politicians, they're all criminals. It's basically, it's a matter of fact. They are criminals.
Well, yeah, I mean, we remember the what used to be the South African FBI, the Scorpions, that was disbanded by Parliament. I mean, how does this – imagine what this would sound like to Americans, that it's announced today in the House of Representatives that there has been a vote – to disband the FBI. This is now after the FBI has attempted to indict around half of them for being small-time crooks. So the crooks sitting, you know, sorry, the crook sitting in the House of Representatives voted to disband the FBI because the FBI has essentially got charges laid against them for being crooks. That really happened in South Africa. That happened back in like 2009, as I recall. Right? And after that, the chief crook became the president. His name was Zuma.
Yes, it's literally. Once again, it's not opinion about these things. These are matters of fact. Zuma, we know that he's a criminal now. We know that he's a criminal. There's criminal indictments against him. Not one, not two indictments, hundreds of indictments against this person.
When you tell people in the United States this, or even here in Canada, I tell it to Canadians, and they look at me and they say, yeah, you know, politicians are corrupt, you know. Just look at what happened with the SNC-Lavalin case here in Canada. You know, and you just walk away because they just don't get it. They think the slight level of corruption that they have in Canada and the marginal level of corruption they have in the United States, they then try to couch that in the language I use to describe what's happened in South Africa. When I say that in South Africa, politicians have their opposition murdered, I mean, in plain English, politicians in South Africa get people to kill their opponents. People know that. But you say that to a Canadian, he thinks you're just sort of exaggerating for effect. You don't really mean kill. No, I mean kill.
Yes, in the town they're killing scores of one another. Yes, so those are facts, and the extent of corruption. People from outside will never grasp the extent. We're speaking here of maybe 95% of all the state structures that have become corrupt. There's maybe 5% of people in state service who actually only do their job. 95%, this is my calculations, this is my estimates. I'm not saying those are facts that we can prove statistically, but this is my experience. 95% of everything in South Africa has been corrupted. Power supply. I'm sitting here speaking to you with a solar-powered lantern because our power is up for the past 2 hours. Because our state utility Eskom, that has a monopoly in South Africa for producing power, can't produce power. They must be bailed out by Parliament. You have a monopoly for producing electricity in a modern country of 50 million people, and you can't make a profit. How is that possible? not make a profit. Go into the red so far that the government needs to bail you out on a regular basis. How is that possible?
Well, you're looking at what used to be, I think, either the ninth or the 12th biggest economy on earth, okay? And it's been stolen. It's been ransacked to be, you know, a country like Chad now. South Africa used to be the member of a club that contained Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Okay, it had an economy that kind of matched Spain in most respects. Now you have to look in Africa for a country to match it.
Yes. Well, we've become the capital of crime, and we within the next 3 weeks, hear my prediction on this, and I'm going to say what I have in my head. Nedbank, one or two of the other banks, but Nedbank specifically is going to be pulled out as one of the greatest money laundering operations ever on earth. Because South Africa has become the epicenter of the drug, of the money laundering. Basically, all of the organized crime, it's not in New York anymore. It's not the Cosa Nostra in America anymore, Americans. And it's not in Russia anymore. The epicenter of organized crime is South Africa. Because our politicians and our banking system makes it possible. It's as simple as that. The heroin being produced in Afghanistan,
is channeled through South Africa. It's as simple as that. We know those things. It's not conspiracy theory. We know those things. Human trafficking, the greatest human trafficking on earth, is epicentered in South Africa. We are literally the crime capital of the world. If you rehabilitate South Africa, then you also rehabilitate a huge amount of your crime that you experience as Americans from South Africa.
The thing is that South Africa, let me put it to you like this. When I got to Canada in the year 2000, I could not get an electronic transaction done as a private person from my computer. I couldn't do a financial transaction. I had to go to the bank. They did not have significant electronic fund transfer in the hands of consumers. And that came later. But I'd already done it for years in South Africa. I'd done it for most of the 90s in South Africa. So South Africa was leading the world in many of these things. And my comment to you is, you take a sophisticated system like that and you put it in the hands of, quite frankly, corrupt ignoramuses that don't understand what the word corruption means. It's not that they willfully criminally corrupt, is that they are too uneducated, too stupid to know what corrupt is. And they come from a culture where the giving and taking of presents is an essence of existence. You are supposed to give presents to the chief, and the chief is supposed to hand out presents. So it's not like corruption is seen as bad. It's seen as integral to the society. That's after. You put a system like that, put a machine, a well-oiled machine like the old South Africa, you put that in the hands of these people, what the hell do you expect?
Exactly. It's always, and I don't want to sound like a racist, and I'm certainly not speaking in racial terms, but it always reminds me of that picture of the baboon with a razor in his hands. There was this baboon, and one day they gave him a razor, and he's cutting up everything himself included, and he doesn't understand why it's happening. This is really what I'm seeing happening around me. So, yes, what the hell were we?
I repeat, you know, I worked with thoroughly competent people of all ethnicities and all races in South Africa. They're all there, but they're not in government. The creatures in government are the rubbish that floated up to the top on a sea of junk.
Listen, and Professor Burns, we must be very honest and very clear about this. Many of the big brains behind state capture now and a lot of other very funny stuff that went on through the years were people with white skins. I'm going to call names. You can go and read the newspapers as listeners of who are sometimes fingered out as those guys who were the brains behind the operations. Once again, it speaks for itself that the crime underworld, those bosses, very, very quickly realize that they can utilize the system.
This is where it comes back to President Trump 2020. I'll make the connection for you just now. In South Africa, my comment is the ordinary white working stiff has no place. The ordinary white working stiff is the guy who's running to the ground. He has nothing. He has no future. He's hoping that eventually his children might have a hope, but he's not convinced of that. There are many black people who are poorer than him, but everybody bleeds about them. Everybody supposedly tries and help him. At the top of the pile sits a heap of stinking rich people, many of them black, many of them white. But the ordinary guy in the middle, there's nothing left of him. That has been the picture in the United States for a while as well. And President Trump has tapped into this, and he has realized that the ordinary white working stiff is ready to fight to the death. And then when they did the homework, they found that, hey, it's actually not a color thing in the United States anymore. It's just that many black people had been told by mom and dad that they ought to vote Democrat ever since 1968. How did that work out for them? So he's siphoning off black voters, and he's basically collecting everybody who thinks America is supposed to be the land of opportunity.
Yes.
And the numbers discovered, that's actually the majority of the people in the United States. In South Africa, unfortunately, the white working stiff is a tiny minority, and everybody else is just, you know, raping him to get cash.
But because it's basically what's going on. It's a rape for cash. We've heard in so many words that come the new financial year, the tax will once again increase for working class people. And working class people, Americans understand this now. We're not speaking of 60% or 70% as a tax base in South Africa. We're speaking of less than 5 million. And then there's another statistic that usually throw people. Less than 200,000 people in South Africa pay 60% of the taxes. 200,000 of South Africans pay 60% of the taxes.
And they get no benefit back from that.
Nothing. You drive to your house. I drive. I'm not saying I'm one of those 200,000, but I drive to my house and I must literally drive slowly on a tarred road, because the tarred road in the white, supposedly prosperous white town where I live is so broken up that I can't even drive 20 or 30 kilometers an hour to my house. This is literally what I'm getting for my tax. There's nothing. I'm sitting in the dark. Last week we were sitting for a week without running water, but I'm one of the most highly taxed people in the world in my demographic. But I'm not getting anything in return for that, and people just keeps on paying tax.
This is why I want an American who wants to see the future. I want them to get on a plane with they can even get a discount flight at $1,000 every now and then. Fly there and go just live for a week with an ordinary white South African family. Just go do it.
Yes. I always explain it to people when I refer to the security industry in South Africa. Between the South African police services, the former police services, then they have these Johannesburg Metro Police and so forth, but between official police services in South Africa plus the army, we have half of the people employed of what the private security industry is. The private security industry has about 400,000 to 500,000 people already working for them. 400,000 to 500,000 private security people guarding everything in South Africa, because it's murder and mayhem and theft. And that's only for, I would say it as it is, for the rich people who can afford the private security services. So in other words, your private security is twice the size of your police services plus your army. Now imagine yourself in America. How big is the American armed forces? I don't know. Let's say 1 million. Let's say 2 million people. In other words, there would now have to be like 4 or 5 million security officers running around in the United States, just keeping the peace. That's what we are facing, guys. That is what's the reality in South Africa. Yes. Go. please tell me what's going to happen in the next year. And I'm speaking here, Trump being re-elected vis-a-vis South Africa. Can white people expect Trump riding in on a white horse and saving us all, or what would you see as
no, I don't expect Trump on a white horse saving South Africans. And I'll tell you why I'm saying that. I've been writing on the subject since about 2003. I started writing that book in 2006, got serious in 2007, published it in 2013, put it out on paper form in 2014. I've spent 5 years, almost 6 years now, writing further articles using originally the book as the prompt. And I've got to a point where I'm challenging South Africans. I'm saying that I can't defend you if you are not prepared to stand up and speak. And that to me is the problem, is that when somebody looks from outside the country at South Africa, they don't see unhappy white people. They just don't see them. There's not enough noise being made. There's not enough attention being drawn. People are just dying. We've got thousands of farmers dead, and you've got like Katie, what's her name from Britain?
Katie Hopkins and Lauren Southern,
people like that. Gee, you know, they're not even from South Africa. They got on a plane with a camera. They went there and they found out what's going on. I think Lauren Southern had the biggest fright of her life because she's had to kind of work in this North American political scene where everybody exaggerates things. I think what she ran into was actual truth and reality, and it scared the living hell out of her. I don't think she's the same person before and after that. And certainly Katie Hopkins, I mean, I saw her on a Dutch program and she was almost in tears. Okay. She has realized what this is. So two women from overseas have come and shown South African men what it is that's required.
Yes. Yes.
And my comment is, I too am finding it difficult to portray things in South Africa if people in South Africa don't make like they're unhappy. They just carry on. And they all think it's the Christian thing to do. And this is what I mean by saying it's no good trying to be the good Christian. Okay? All you're going to get to be is dead Christian. I'm telling you now.
It's a fact. It's once again a matter of fact being proven by the actual experience we have on the ground. Yes. You will remember when these farmers started to really appear. I was one of those guys that started the boycott News 24 movement way back, I think, in 2007. Of course, there was an actual blackout in our printed media and television on murders in South Africa. They simply didn't report it.
They stopped. I know they did.
Then we got them to start and report these things. And then there was this strange phenomenon, and I think you also alluded to it, where the victim would then go to the farm murderer and they would hug one another and they would be photographs, and everybody would have this nice and fuzzy feeling inside themselves because we are once again reconciling with our enemies. And we still have that. We still have, but they're killing thousands of us now. Now, how can you?
I take a dim view of that kind of thing. Do you remember 1993, the young American girl, a Fulbright student in Cape Town?
Yes, who, Amy Beale.
Yes. Amy Beale was stoned to death by a mob in, I think it was Khayelitsha, Cape Town.
Yes.
And Walanga and Nyanga, Khayelitsha, I'm not sure which one. And then the parents came over from America and they were all forgiving and said all these nice little phrases and things. Okay. And I listened to that at the time and I thought, you have a right to do that.
Yes.
Someone, if the someone doesn't think he's done something wrong. What has that got to do with Christianity? Forgiving someone if the someone thinks he hasn't done something wrong. What does the word forgive then mean? So that's not Christianity. That's just a psychological cheapskate dodge. So they went to court. The parents are in court hearing the testimony from those who did the killing. And you know what happened? The supporters in the visitors gallery laughed when the killing was described.
Yes. They laughed. I remember that vividly. I can back you up on that. I remember it vividly. They were actually laughing with the explanation of how she was stoned to death.
And that is what happens. That is what happens when you forgive someone who doesn't think he's done something wrong.
Yes. Prof, we have about 3 minutes left. Final words from you. The way forward for white South Africans, I know it's very dark at this point in time. Expropriation is most probably going to start taking place. What in two or three sentences, what do we do at this point in time?
Three words. Thanks. Scream bloody murder.
Yes.
Particularly the United States. It's particularly the United States that doesn't take any attention of something that just sits around and festers. You have to scream bloody murder.
Yes.
And other South Africans are raised not to do that. You have to forget what Mama and Papa told you. It is time to take to the streets and scream bloody murder.
Yes, rage against the dying of the light. Rage against the dying of
you
the
don't,
light.
You don't have the right to shut up any further.
I like that.
If you look at your fellow human being in South Africa, it's your damn job to scream your head off.
Indeed. Thank you, Professor Boyens. Once again, 2 hours flew. I really apologize for the technical errors. It's always, to our listeners, it's always this thing of bringing people from literally across the globe. We're sitting on so many different time zones and so many different data feeds and bandwidth and all these things. Just simply to bring people together on a show like this is an operation itself. So I apologize sincerely. But once again, a magnificent program. You heard from Jason and you heard from Professor Duenz. Thank you very much for this.
I'm praying for that young man because I think he's very brave and my heart goes out to him. I just hope he gets something to happen over there. But it's a really bad time for it.
Yes. The winter is coming up, but we're never going to stop rooting for him. Thank you very much. For our listeners, thank you very much for listening to us. We will be back next week, same time, same place. Radio 3 South Africa. It's called Konamarva. I'm signing off. And a very pleasant evening to yourselves. Goodbye, folks.